I think that it's just as damaging to condemn any expressions of traditional femininity as unfeminist.
Yeah.
As it is to tell women that you have to express yourself in these traditionally feminine ways.
I'm not wearing mascara because I want everyone to like me. I'm wearing mascara, 12-year-old me, because I think it's cool and interesting. Right.
Right.
And we're going.
Hello, friends.
Hi, everyone.
We are back.
Rhonda found me.
We're still alive. That's the important thing.
I was in Dune Land. Uh-huh. I was in.
You were on Arrakis.
There was a lot of sand. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot.
It happens, you know. You go to Arrakis. You get addicted to spice. You become a Freeman. You ride a sandworm. Yeah. Like it happens.
And now I'm sitting here recording on two separate computers. That's great. I've changed.
You've hacked into the mainframe.
I have indeed.
Yeah. So hello, we are back. I know you probably thought you had gotten rid of us, but
we
could not just leave that conversation hanging. We have to keep talking about Barbie.
Nor did we want to leave the conversation. It was more like in a buddy comedy where they're going along to their destination and then hijinks happen in the middle. We were just in our hijinks. Yeah. It's fine.
Lots of hijinks. Yeah. And lots of hijinks. Actually, I did not do very many hijinks. Not nearly as many hijinks as I would have preferred, but that's okay.
You know, you got to give yourself time to plan a hijink. That's true. It's hard.
It's true. A hijink takes preparation and careful planning, you know, because you don't want to just have your hijinks all willy-nilly. Like,
no.
You know?
And we really wanted to give you a bad joke right at the top here, because I'm sure you were missing them. So you're welcome.
You are so welcome. So we're back. We're Pop DNA, and we are talking about Barbie again.
Yeah.
Yeah, but before we do, Erin, I know there's been so much that we have watched and consumed in this time apart. What have you been watching/consuming?
I can tell you for sure that I have finished the second season of The Bear. Excellent. And that I'm fully obsessed with it.
Yep, season 3 is coming soon.
June.
It's coming. Yeah, things are coming in June.
So many.
Like House of the Dragon season 2.
Yeah.
Is in June. The second half of Bridgerton season 3.
Oh,
is in
nice.
June. What else was it? There are like a couple other things that I'm like, oh my gosh. Oh, Interview with the Vampire, which I haven't watched season 1, but apparently season 2 is coming in June. A lot of people I know really, really like it. So I was thinking, oh, maybe
I've heard
I should
good
watch
things
that.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, those are the things.
And then.
Oh, and.
My new.
And.
Yeah.
And something else that's coming in June. What have I been saying? What have I been talking about?
Oh.
The Acolyte. Oh. The Acolyte is premiering in June, and I am so excited. Okay, you're going to say something.
Yeah. Oh, I have been reading The Threads of Power, too, by V.E. Schwab. So that's been really enjoyable. I've taken to walking down. There's like an hour-long walk to some really nice water where I live, and I've been taking to walk down there, and then I feel like Belle from Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, yeah.
Because I walk in my little, in the small town part of Tacoma, it feels like. And then I'm
reading
my little
book.
Tacoma
is just like a big small town, so.
It really is. It just has so many of them.
Yeah.
So I've been reading the Threads of Power series, which has been really nice and fun. And there's Secret Pirates,
which I
didn't realize.
What are the books in that series?
So there's the Threads of Power, and then let me grab it really quick.
I've read V.E. Schwab, but I haven't heard of that.
Because I got the name wrong. The Fragile Threads of Power is the first book. And then, let me just crack open this baby. Oh dear. I'm actually not sure what the second one is called, but it's a trilogy.
Okay.
And it's really good.
Is it new?
It's really, I think 2023.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Interesting.
And so it follows, there are four different versions of London. There's regular London, grey London, red London.
Oh, this is Shades of Magic.
It is, but it's not, is the weird thing. So there's, I have those books too.
Oh, is this like more in the same universe?
I believe so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Because I read the Shades of Magic trilogy. That's from like, you know, quite a while ago.
So if she
wrote more in the same universe, I was not aware.
Yeah, they extended the universe, and this one came out this year, but it's not like the same story. So this is the first in this newer trilogy in the same world that they've created. So yeah, it's really, I really like it. The cover is gorgeous. It's a lot of fun. I also tried to read this book called The Saturday Night Ghost Club.
Huh.
And it was really cute. There was like a three, it was basically Stand By Me, but they're hunting ghosts. Oh. And they have this like eccentric uncle who's like owns an occult shop and whatever. And then there started to be like iconography was described in a xenophobic way. Oh, and then the little girl started to chew tobacco and she's like 11. And then there's like some like trauma. It just wasn't like any one of those would be a good stopping point, right? Uh-huh. But then it had all three. It was just kind of like, okay. So. But let's end on an excited note. This book, The Fragile Threads of Power, is very good. It, I play this game lately where I don't read what the synopsis is. I just start to read the book.
Oh.
And so then it's like I have no roadmap at all or expectation, and it's become really fun.
Yeah.
Because then you're not going for like the, when do we get to this thing? Or I thought it would be like this. You're just on a journey with a storyteller, and it's been really fun. What have you been enjoying, my friend?
Well, I have recently watched several things in a subgenre that I like to call women doing crimes.
Yes.
So this kicked off because I realized that I had not finished the final season of Good Girls, which I don't know if you ever watched that.
Ooh,
with Retta and Christina Hendricks, where I just
stopped watching it.
Yeah. I think I ended up watching like, I think I stopped watching like around the beginning of the final season, and I never finished the final season. So I did that.
It was good though.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I really enjoyed it. Like, yeah, it's a little ridiculous, but like fun at the same time. So like it's perfect. Yeah. Perfect blend. So yeah. So I rewatched that, and then I was like, I want more things where women do crimes. So I rewatched Hustlers, which, you know, was from what, 2019? So
I think so. Like it's
a little old now, but yeah, I rewatched that. It's still great. And then I watched a movie I'd been wanting to see for a little while called Emily the Criminal, which is with Aubrey Plaza.
I love that movie.
Yeah. And it was great. I hadn't seen it before, like a couple days ago when I watched it. And yeah, like it was really good. And it was all like, so like individually, like all of these things, you know, are great and, you know, fun in various ways. But like, as I was like looking at like these three works in particular as like sort of a subgenre, I was like, yeah, they're so like, they all kind of circle around this point that they never actually get to, which is that capitalism doesn't work for everyone. Because it's like these women, like they're all about women who resort to crime because like legal means are not sufficient for them to have like everything they need. And so they, you know, start stealing. They start, you know, committing various forms of theft. To really just to make ends meet, is how it starts out for all of the women in all of these stories. And and it's like they get Emily the criminal, I think, probably gets the closest to actually naming that, like,
right,
this is what our society has come to, right? But it, even it still doesn't quite get to that point, because like she goes to she goes to somewhere in South America, but they don't say exactly where, but and then she like starts running a similar con there, and it's like, well, she's gotten out of one, you know, terrible and exploitative economic system, but she's just gone to another one. I'm like, it's interesting, right?
And Aubrey Plaza in it is really good.
She's so good.
You get full force of her, like, power. I love it. Yeah, she's great.
Like, you feel, like, her desperation, but also, like, her, like, she has, like, a few moments of, like, softness and, like, where she, you know, has, like, real empathy for other characters, and you're like, ah, she's so good. It was a really good movie. I liked it.
I watched it randomly one night. I just saw like, oh, Aubrey Plaza, and I put it on, not again, not really knowing what it was, and then I was like really engrossed in it.
Yeah,
it was really good.
Yeah. And then of course what everyone is talking about, the album To Define a Generation.
It's so good.
Cowboy Carter.
Oh my goodness.
Like, what? Oh, Beyonce. My love.
Beyonce? Beyonce, thank you.
So good. Okay, so my favorite song right now, at least, is Daughter. And when, like, halfway through the song, she just busts out Caro Mio Ben, which is, like,
amazing.
The song that we all had to sing, like, sophomore year in high school, if you're a choir kid. And we're all just like, it's a classical music. We gotta sing this, blah, blah, blah. And then Beyonce puts it in her song. And it's like, how did she, how did she do this? How did she make this cool? I don't,
How did she do this? Her whole vocal performance throughout the whole album is just stunning.
Like, it's okay, so classically trained Beyonce, we hear you. She's so good.
I was fully shocked at how well her voice blends with Miley Cyrus.
I was too. I was like, they both have such like distinct voices. You wouldn't think that they would blend very well, and but they do.
I walked into that not knowing a lot either, because I haven't really heard a lot of Miley Cyrus's stuff. Mm-hmm. Not, like, because I was avoiding it or anything. I just, you know, it hasn't come across my desk, as it were. But I really like Miley's voice.
Yeah.
And I really like the way it blends with Beyonce's. It was really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Jolene.
Mm-hmm.
The Jolene cover. The Blackbird cover.
Yeah. Oh, the Blackbird cover made me, sob my little
How much did she have to pay Paul McCartney to be able to cover it? Honestly, Paul McCartney should pay her. Like,
he should be so lucky.
He should be so lucky. And I wonder if Ringo is still got any kickback from that.
Damn it, Ringo.
Ringo! Ringo, he's the nose of the group. So yes, Cowboy Carter is a masterpiece. And a little preview, we're going to be talking about that in a bonus episode sometime soon.
Bonus.
Yeah. So stay tuned for that, listeners.
I also just really love the art and the photography that goes along with Cowboy Carter. I think some of those photos really show the lack of respect that women and women of color go through. Mm-hmm. I think some of those photos really are just breathtaking. If you haven't seen them, go take a look.
And that she worked with like several Black women who are currently in country music, that she worked with them on singing on Blackbird. Yes. We love it.
No, I'm just thinking about Beyonce.
When are we not thinking about Beyonce?
When are we not? Well, that's really the thing that always goes through my mind, too, is like, she's been a force in our lives since we were, what, 8? 10? Like, she has followed us our whole lives. It's incredible. Yeah,
she is the moment.
Just the body of work. Mm-hmm. And then, like you said, she's dipping into opera. Like, are you kidding me?
Well, I mean, she has, like, an opera background. Like, she trained, you know, classically.
Yeah.
And, and just, like, the roots of country music are so entwined with African American history. And how she has, like, really highlighted that with this work, I think, is not just, you know, like, yeah, it's a great album, but I think it's also like a really historically important album. And we're going to look back. Yeah. We're going to look back on it, you know, 20 years from now and be like, this changed something. Right.
Yeah.
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 It's really cool. What a time to be alive. You know,
what a time.
We've got Beyonce. Yeah. We've got Barbie. Beyonce,
let her be.
What a time to be alive.
What a time.
Should we talk about Barbie?
We don't talk about... Yeah, of course. Yes.
We don't talk about Barbie. No, we're not doing that.
We do. We super do. We do all the time, actually.
As we alluded to in part one, which was, you know, almost 2 months ago. So there's a lot to talk about with Barbie Land. And I think that the idea of Barbie Land, I think, is so intriguing to a lot of us who watched Barbie, because it's this, like, it's supposed to be like the opposite of our world, right? Where like women are the dominant gender.
Yeah.
And women have all of the power. It's women who kind of control how that society and how that culture functions and the things that are important to that culture. So I think that that's a really intriguing idea. And that is an idea that has been coming up in fiction for a really, really long time. So I think that we should explore that a little bit.
Agreed.
Yes. So way back when Barbie first came out, I made a list of books that you should read if you liked Barbie. And I had them kind of divided into like different categories. So under the category of this like kind of feminist utopia setting, I talked about a book called Her Land by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who is the author of The Yellow Wallpaper, that story that we all had to read junior year of high school.
Yeah.
So she also, she wrote a lot of like feminist fiction, and she wrote this book called Her Land that is about this society that is entirely made up of women, and they reproduce asexually, so they don't need men. It's like the mascara in Wonder Woman, like basically.
Yeah.
I didn't even put that on this list, but that kind of works into this too. Like the mascara and Barbie Land kind of have a lot in common, which is interesting, right? Like,
really interesting.
I'm just connecting this. So Barbie broke the record. So like it was the highest grossing film by a solo woman director. And it broke the record for that set by Wonder Woman.
Oh, wow.
Just, like, so interesting, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
We should talk more about the connection, like, culturally.
Yeah.
Between Barbie and Wonder Woman. Anyway, so, right. So, Her Land by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. So, it's this society that's entirely made up of women, and it's through the perspective of three men who discover this place, Her Land. And,
oh, interesting.
And they all have, like, different perspectives on, like, how to approach it. So there's like one of the men is like, this is, you know, this is so terrible. They don't know how wonderful men are. We need to introduce men into this society. Right. And then like there's another one who's kind of like an Alan, and he's like, oh no, this is like, this is fine. Like, the, you know, that's great. So anyway, so it's interesting. It's really more interesting as a thought experiment rather than as like an actual piece of fiction that I would read to enjoy. But it's interesting.
Sure. Yeah.
So Her Land by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, and then The Power by Naomi Alderman, which like I feel like at the time that The Power came out in like 2016, there was like a lot of comparison with Her Land, which I thought was really interesting because The Power, so like most of The Power takes place in like ostensibly present day, right? But it's bookended by this like far future where society has completely flipped and women are now the dominant gender and men are kind of subservient. It, like, in eerily parallel ways to how women are subservient now.
Yeah.
Which is, again, just so interesting, like, as a thought experiment. But The Power is also, like, interesting as a piece of fiction at the same time.
It's been on my TBR for a million years. I'm looking at my copy of it right now.
Yeah, like it's just really, really good. Yeah, so anyway, so The Power basically, like, explores how that flip happens. Like, what happens to cause this change where women become the dominant gender over men.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then a third book that I just wanted to mention, which I think is really interesting to think about in the context of Barbie Land and how we think about this kind of gender flipped society, is Ritual of Proof by Dara Joy, which is actually I guess technically it's a romance novel, but it takes place in like a far future society on another planet where like the founders of this society had as their reference point like historical romance novels. And so they structured their society based on like the societal structures that we see in historical romances, but with the genders flipped. So like women are like the dukes and lords and like kind of running this society. And then men are seen as there's a lot of like, you know, concern about like the men's marriage prospects and like their reputations.
Interesting.
And like, yes, it's so interesting. And it's also really, just a fun read, but like interesting to think about too.
I wanna read this.
Yeah,
that sounds great.
You should definitely read it. Yeah. So like The Power and Ritual of Proof are obviously like more recent, but Her Land, you know, is from like the early 20th century. So like, obviously this is an idea we've been thinking about for a long time, right?
Yeah.
And then we also have like these like science fiction movies from like the 1950s where this kind of Queen of Outer Space, I think, is probably like the most famous one, but there's like a few others. So there's one called Cat Women in Space, and Fire Maidens of Outer Space. So in these movies, this like all female planet is ruled by powerful women and it's at peace until male space explorers arrive. The women fall for these men because, you know, oh, I've never seen a man before. And they lose control of the society. And eventually the men in each of these movies dismantle these societies and they establish patriarchy. So this is basically what Ken does to Barbie Land. And of course, you know, they, like, the men in these movies get their pick of, like, the women. This is in the words of this video essay that I watched about this. Stratton, the video essayist, says, "Ladylands are not so thinly veiled fantasy stories for men disguised by female empowerment." So I think it's interesting to look at the contrast between, like, these sci-fi movies where it's framed as like a triumph when the men restore patriarchy to these all-female societies versus works that are written by women and from this feminine perspective about how a similar situation, you know, is framed very differently in that context. And so looking at Barbie Land in the context of this history of exploring this idea of, you know, a female-centric society, I think that there's a lot that we can kind of extrapolate from the film's depiction of Barbie Land, but also there's a lot that, you know, like we were discussing in part one, like there's a lot about Barbie Land that when you look beneath the surface is maybe, you know, not as utopia like as it first appears. So like we have this place where all the Barbies are, you know, ostensibly are like social equals, right? Like we have a President Barbie and we have a Supreme Court, you know, Barbies on the Supreme. So like we have like Barbies in positions of political power. But then we also have like, you know, a garbage truck Barbie and, you know, other Barbies that like in our world might be seen as like lower class. But it appears that like everyone is, you know, equally accepted socially. But then we have Weird Barbie. Who is ostracized. Who is basically living up on the hill like the Grinch. And then, you know, we have the Kens who basically we kind of learn are essentially unhoused. They just all live on the beach, I guess. Like, does anyone know?
Barbie doesn't know. And
then there's like, and then there's like Midge and Skipper. Who are also kind of weirdly made outsiders.
There's an equality, like we see in our world today, there's an equality that's bragged about but isn't actually what's delivered.
It's like the appearance. But in practice, it's not the reality. So I, of course, did a lot of reading about this topic. So there was an article that I really connected with called Barbietopia and Feminist Futures, Next Steps on the Heroine's Journey by Ivana Milojevic. I hope I'm saying that right. So this, it gets into like, what is the society? Like, what is the feminism of Barbie Land? So there's like some good quotes that I just pulled out that I'll just kind of read through here. So this talks about like how Barbie, like the Margot Robbie Barbie that we're following, you know, for the whole movie. So she has this, quote, an intimate brush with her personal dystopia. So viewing Barbie Land through our main Barbie's perspective at the beginning, it is actually perfect. It is actually a utopia.
Right.
But it's when she has the intrusive thought about, oh, I could die someday. That's when, in her view, it becomes less perfect. And it's through her personal view of herself, because she, you know, her feet are flat all of a sudden and she has cellulite, and to her, like, these are the worst things that could happen to her.
Yeah.
Because she sees her value as being in physical beauty.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, beauty standards are a weird thing in Barbie Land too. But
yeah.
So right, so then, like, when she goes to the real world and sort of is awakened to the reality of patriarchy. This says, the movie subtly suggests that our perceptions of reality shaped by gender are indeed social constructs characterized by mutability and fluidity. So her perception of her gender in Barbie Land is, like, tied to her physicality.
Yeah.
In a way that so many people's perceptions of gender in general in our world are tied to physicality, which, you know, is also a really interesting thing.
Yeah.
So this also goes a little bit into, like, the idea of real world ideas and, like, theories about, like, a more women-centric society beyond fiction, like ways that this, you know, could actually happen in the real world. So this says, during the radical feminist movement of the 1960s, the exploration of women-centric alternatives was undertaken within the framework of collectively challenging the oppressive force of patriarchy. Any propagation of patriarchy's dominion, even if presented as an empowerment rooted in the conventional contours of femininity, and particularly if tailored to suit the male gaze, was to be unequivocally avoided at all costs. So this idea of, like, the traditional, like, material objects of femininity and aesthetics of traditional femininity, which we definitely see in Barbie Land, right? Yeah. Like, it's, you know, it's very pink. It's all, like, it's very, very traditionally feminine. So that's, like, the opposite of how the feminist movements of the 1960s would have preferred, like, women-centric, which, you know, is, like, such a, talking about gender and, like, as a feminine person,
yeah,
who, you know, connects with traditional femininity in a lot of ways, personally, for me, I, like, it's something that I've thought about a lot, that, like, am I connecting with traditional femininity because I actually feel a connection with it?
Right.
Or because it's what's expected of me.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't know if you feel that at all.
I think when I was, I remember really clearly when I was, I think, 11 or 12, I asked my mom if I could still be feminist and wear makeup. Because I was confused about a lot of the images I was getting as an 11 or 12 year old about, like, what femininity is and who defines that. But I wouldn't have put a name on it that way. That's, like, from being a scholar and thinking about gender studies. But
yeah,
I think back to that question where I turned to my mom and I said, am I allowed to do this? And still, can it be both? Anyway, I think it's really interesting how we learn those things.
And I don't think it's something that I personally will ever be 100% certain about, you know?
Yeah.
Because, totally. Like, yeah, because I feel like it would be just as much of a response to expected gender roles to reject traditional femininity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To consciously be like, I'm not going to be what society expects a woman to be. I'm gonna, right? Because it's just as much like letting my personal expression be affected by patriarchy, right?
Yeah, and it's finding that middle balance about what you actually identify with, but then you have to unpack where you're getting those narratives, and it just becomes a lot, I think. Like, there's those movements of, like, comfort core, where you're rejecting all of, or, like, comfort core, or, like, there's different words for it, but where you dress to be comfortable, you don't dress to be cute or feminine or whatever. And there's so many different iterations of that, but it was on a, I listened to Add to Cart with Suchin Pak and Kulat Vilaysak, and they were talking about the comfort core movement, where they're wearing their brightly colored Crocs with all the giblets in them, and they're wearing like a gigantic sweatshirt that they really loved the color of, but isn't whatever form fitting or whatever they're supposed to be. And they're in their mid to late 40s. And so they're having these conversations about the narratives they've been given and how to kind of dispel those. Anyway, it's interesting how much of that is you, and how much of that even still is you being told what you're supposed to identify with. It's kind of fascinating.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting that we see in Barbie, like, I don't think it doesn't really get overt about this, but I think that we see in how Barbie is, like, costumed mostly. We kind of see that sort of evolution because, of course, at the beginning, she's in all pink dresses. And, you know, like, by the end, like, her costuming gets a little bit more, like, it's still feminine and it's still soft, but it brings in a little bit more, like, what we would consider, like, masculine clothing aesthetics. Like, especially, like, the very last scene, like, she's wearing, like, a blazer. So I think that it's just as damaging to condemn any expressions of traditional femininity as unfeminist as it is to tell women that you have to express yourself in these traditionally feminine ways. And so I think that it's, I think overall a positive that Barbie presents such a traditionally feminine aesthetic while having this conversation about feminism.
It reminds me of rejection-sensitive dysphoria, where you're looking for confirmation from everyone else instead of using that muscle where you decide what you like and what you're going to do based. I think that's feminist. I think you sitting with yourself and deciding what you want is, in this term, for me, feminist, versus that rejection sensitive, oh, is this what they want me to be? Is this what they want me to do?
Right.
Kind of thing. And I think for me, that's the distinction. Like, I'm not wearing mascara because I want everyone to like me. I'm wearing mascara, 12-year-old me, because I think it's cool and interesting. Right. So.
Right.
But it's different for everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like that when in Gilmore Girls, when Lorelai is talking about how, like, she tried a Pop-Tart for the first time and she, like, starts questioning, like, do I actually like the things I like because I like them, or is it because it's what, you know, my parents told me not to do, right?
And that's a really scary can of worms, because we do it in opposition of people. We do it in subtle ways. Like, it's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's something we talk a lot, obviously, in the therapy room, surprising no one.
So, okay, so to wrap up this article, this actually, I think, leads really nicely into your kind of thoughts and conversation here.
I'm noticing that this feels really like a natural thing.
So to kind of wrap up this idea of, you know, gender and feminism within Barbie land. So in this article, the author kind of wraps this up by talking about, like, the role of satire within Barbie land, kind of as a dystopia. So she says, a cautionary reminder that no utopia remains exempt from change and consequences. Because, like, you know, we, like, in all of the fictional works that I talked about, like, there's always, like, some kind of contrast with that idea of, like, this feminine ruled society, right?
Yeah.
So it simultaneously manipulates perception, coaxing us to accept that a doll long criticized for perpetuating unrealistic body image for women and for perpetuating detrimental ideals to young girls can abruptly be rebranded as a feminist icon. So kind of like we were talking about last time, that, like, it reads as kind of disingenuous for Mattel to, you know, try to push this narrative about Barbie when that, you know, anyway, so she goes on, instead of challenging the established norms of femininity and feminine beauty, the narrative upholds and refines those very standards. Naturally, the expected response is to acquire more of these dolls, thus perpetuating the cycle. So I think that's an interesting point, is that it's in kind of allowing and celebrating, like, traditional femininity and feminine aesthetics. It's also, at least in this writer's view, it's upholding that as the standard. I don't necessarily agree with that, but it's interesting that that's kind of what was extrapolated.
Yeah.
Which is, interesting.
It is interesting because it's one of those movies, I think, where you have to watch it a lot in order to, like, start to really think these things through. Like, I see the movie completely differently now that I'm on my, like, fifth and sixth watch than I did in my first one. You know, it's just... And I think that's a lot of what you have to do as you unlearn things and as you kind of come back to yourself. So it's interesting to me that that would also feel true about needing to watch Barbie 5 and 6 times to kind of see what's going on in there. As we were talking just now, I really resonated with what you said about we see it through stereotypical Barbie's viewpoints. So it does seem like a utopia because she's... She fits, right? She fits in there. She's what the world was made for. And that reminds me of how we get these narratives and how we get what we should be versus who we actually are and what we actually do identify with. There is a type of therapy called narrative therapy, which asks client. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's really wonderful. It asks the client to kind of take a look at the stories that they've received about themselves and the meaning that they make from it. So how they begin to define their world based on the stories that have been told about them and the stories that they tell themselves. You might have heard the phrase, oh, the story I was telling myself was, that can be used really nicely in a fight or in an argument, where you explain, this is what I told myself about what was happening. This was my point of view. But then there's also work to be done where you place things that you're shameful about on a fictional character, and you explore your shame or your reactions or your anger or, you know, your views on how you should be expressing femininity on a character, and then kind of, like, extrapolate meaning from that, like, exploring your own identity and definitions. And that is why I think that this movie is fully therapist friendly, if not consulted, because I think that exactly what we're watching is an exploration of narrative therapy. All of, you know, female identifying, male identifying, all across the spectrum there, we can take a look at Barbie and this movie and see a should or a narrative that we were told to uphold, forced to uphold, didn't identify with, did identify with. I think it's really there for such an all-encompassing thing as Barbie, right? Like, you've experienced Barbie in some form or fashion, and it's made potentially, you know, it's made an impact on the should in your life, right? It's kind of, I don't know. When you played, did you play with Barbies? I think you did.
Oh, yeah.
Did they make you feel powerful? Did they make you feel kind of, what was the feeling with them, I wonder?
How did I feel? I think for me, in a sense, Barbies were kind of aspirational.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this was like how I conceptualized what adulthood would be like.
Sure.
Was through how I played with Barbies. So like, I think I talked about how like a lot of what I did with Barbies was just like kind of creating vignettes, right? Like creating scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Or like just doing like very mundane things, like going to the store, cooking dinner, right? Like these, like, so like when I envisioned adulthood as a kid, like I definitely thought about, you know, like, what do I want to be when I grow up? Like, what do I want to do? What do I want to accomplish? But I also thought about those kind of things, like the adult things that you have to do. And that I used Barbie to explore that aspect of adulthood rather than like my ambitions or dreams or anything.
Right. Yeah.
Which I think is, I don't know why.
No, but for like, sure.
That was how I, you know, I had other things that I did. So like, you know, when I thought about like what I want to be when I grow up, it was usually like some kind of writer or artist or sometimes it was teacher, but like I explored those things through actually doing them.
Yeah.
So like I used Barbie to explore like the more, you know, practical aspects of being an adult.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know.
No, super, super interesting. I just think about it because of Emma's response to Barbie in her, I think, middle school, right? Emma's middle school.
Or Sasha.
Sasha. Who the heck is Emma then? Sasha.
Are you thinking of America Ferrera's daughter on Superstore? Because her name was Emma.
Her name is Emma. Aw, Rhonda, I love that you knew that that's what I did. Sasha.
Like, that's where your brain was.
Because I just, I have also been watching a rewatch of that beautiful show.
You don't have to change it in the notes. It's fine. I knew who you meant.
I think of Sasha's response to Barbie when we see her, I think she's in middle school. We see her really confront Barbie. Sasha says to Barbie, "You've done nothing but harm. You've given us all of these narratives, and this is the impact that you've had on me, and this is why I don't relate to you. This is why I don't play with Barbies. This is why I'm not excited that you're here," that kind of thing. And I think that that was a viewpoint that was really explored in my generation growing up. Certainly it sounds like in Sasha's and younger generations, I think that was really the kind of negative reaction to Barbie, because, you know, in a lot of ways she does create a should, right? There is some form of that being created, as we discussed. So we get that kind of bumping up with should. We get, and I'm interested, I would be really, really interested to hear your take on this. But when we're sitting with the woman at the bus stop, when Barbie gets to Barbie Land, and Barbie cries and says, "You're beautiful." And then she says, "I know it."
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, it always feels to me like a defiance.
Yeah.
And it makes me lose my mind every time. I cry so hard at that point, because it just shows me how much we do have to be defiant sometimes to like to walk around in this world, to be proud of ourselves, to show ourselves love can feel really defiant. And I don't know, I loved that moment.
Well, and I think that moment is so interesting. Like, it's so beautiful. I think it's one of the best moments in the movie. And I also think that it's interesting. So like kind of like we were talking about, like Barbie, stereotypical Barbie, ties her worth to her physical beauty, which is, you know, like, however you feel about that, like, it's not, you know.
Yeah.
But so when she sees that this woman that she, you know, is sitting next to at the bus stop, and she tells her that she's beautiful, she's like, she's recognizing that this woman has worth and value.
Yeah.
But it's still, she's still kind of caught up in like that physical beauty being connected with worth and value.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, I don't know. This is another thing that I am like constantly questioning myself about, that I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with wanting physical beauty and with, you know, like admiring physical beauty in other people and celebrating it. But it's also like, but who decides what is beautiful?
Yeah.
And why do I think, you know, whatever I think is beautiful, why is that? And
yeah.
And why is it so important?
And this is why I think this movie feels like it was written by a narrative therapist, because those are all the questions you would ask in a session. You would ask, okay, where did we get that? Why did we? And over the course of a few months or years, potentially, you would, like, we would all come to a definition of where we got those terms, right? Because I have the same thing. I also talked about this with a colleague of mine, where if I'm preparing for an interview for like a job and I want to feel professional, I will do my makeup and I'll get a good outfit.
Yeah. Or if you're going on a first date.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you're choosing the things about your physical appearance with like one very specific aim in mind, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you're going on a date with a man, which, like, I've never, you know, I've never been on a date with someone who wasn't a man, so I don't know what it's like.
Sure, yeah.
But, like, you know that, like, in a sense, you are still kind of, you're aware of the male gaze.
Uh-huh.
If you are romantically involved with a man. And in a sense, like, you're kind of, like, still wanting to cater to it a little bit.
Yeah.
But like, not.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
It really
is. Can you just be my therapist, Erin? Because I.
We all need to go to narrative therapy, because I think it is really helpful. Because I think the first, like, there were years of my life where I wasn't even questioning where we get these narratives and where we get these stories about should. For a long time, I just accepted it as, oh, no, this is how I am to act in the world. This is what is expected of me. And it's just so interesting to take a look at kind of where we get these stories and the stories that we tell ourselves. My favorite moment of this whole movie, I think, is when you watch the home videos of women living their life. I mean, I could cry about it right now. I feel the tears. Gosh. Like,
Every time I've rewatched that movie, like, other moments have kind of tempered in their impact, but that moment, I am still just like a mess.
Like, I'm pretty
just hearing the song, the Billie Eilish song, I'm just like,
I have a distinct memory of the three of us sitting at the movies and feeling all of us just start to, like,
yes, like, sob everyone at that moment. Everyone in the theater was like, oh, yeah.
And it's because those moments of humanity, those moments, those smaller moments of what it really reminds me of it turns from the gaze of should and the media and perhaps Barbie Land to the gaze of us loving other people and what mm-hmm. we love about other people. So putting it on, like, I think of the specific use, the intentional use of kind of a home video style where someone yeah. you love is videoing you, but you don't, might not realize it, or you're caught up in a moment like there's a mom or a grandmother who's just like dancing and celebrating herself mm-hmm. or
yeah.
there's a woman putting on some mascara and then catching someone videoing her.
Yeah.
And it shifts the gaze from this.
I like the lady who's bowling and she gets a strike and she turns around and everybody like is cheering and celebrating yeah. with her. That's my favorite.
The gaze gets to shift to being from someone that loves you and knows you the mm-hmm. most. And I think that's so important as we work to think about should, to shift it mm-hmm. to yourself. And that's why that moment just makes me sob my whole eyes out.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I think it's interesting too that moment, the moment on the bench with the woman, Greta Gerwig has highlighted as it's the heart of the movie in a Rolling yeah. Stone interview. Ugh, Greta. I'm all out of, I just almost cried. I'm all out of words. I also, though, I always worry, well, I guess I'll stop here. I always worry about Weird Barbie. The more that I yeah. watch this movie, the more she kind of continues to be the butt of the joke, even when mm-hmm. she's apologized to, it's still a little bit.
And then she's made like the Secretary of Sanitation or something.
Yeah. Like,
okay.
I worry about her.
Yeah.
I just, and even like her and Midge, I just, there's, and I get it. And we talked about this in the last one about, what is this movie responsible for and what is it not? We obviously right, yeah. cannot explore yeah. everything. It is a movie.
And I think it's like, yes, it's a movie. It's also, it's not hiding the fact that it is a commercial. Like it's not, you know, it's not trying to hide that it's a Mattel product made to sell Mattel products. So,
yeah. And how, just how much they lost the point, but also didn't when they started making Weird Barbie, like when Mattel started manufacturing Weird Barbie, and right. we're all just like,
yeah, no,
that's not what we were saying.
You've missed the point.
you've lost the plot, yeah. friend. You've lost the plot. But if this was all a commercial, then great job.
Yeah.
And I had a quote here about Weird Barbie, but I really just think there's so many of our personal narratives are wrapped up in Weird Barbie that it's hard to remove yourself from that, I think.
Yeah.
Like that clip where they're making Weird, the little girl is making Weird Barbie and she's playing the Spice Girls and
yes.
she's Colors of the World, Spice Up Your Life.
Uh-huh.
For such a little clip, it just encompassed so much of what it was to grow up in the 90s.
That was the perfect song for that moment.
Oh, absolutely.
Like how we need to do a whole episode about how perfect the soundtrack is.
Oh, so good. Like,
the Indigo Girls,
yes.
Matchbox 20, like, those are the two opposite ends of a spectrum. The Indigo Girls and Matchbox 20.
Just how often I've been serenaded with a guitar and you really just sitting there like,
or had the Godfather mansplained to you. The Godfather.
The Godfather.
How many times has a film bro been like, oh, but did you really understand this
did
movie?
You really
Let me explain it?
It
to you.
Look at you, Fred Armisen. I can only imagine.
Oh my gosh.
You on a date, sir.
Gross.
So in conclusion, gross Fred Armisen.
Yeah.
Gross.
Yeah. And why wasn't Elizabeth Moss in this movie?
Why wasn't she in this movie?
Maybe for Barbie too.
I've also just loved watching Margot Robbie take back her identity a little bit. Like,
yes,
she
totally,
she very iconically wore pink and I think recreated a whole Barbie, like classic Barbie look. Mm-hmm. But then the next award show, she's like, no, I'm done. It's over now.
Yeah.
This is me, Margot Robbie, not anyone else. Thank you.
Well, and I think it's, so she's the, you know, it's her production company that made this movie. And I think it's so interesting to see her evolution, like, as an actress and then, like, in, like, what she's done as a producer, because, you know, like we think of like her as Harley Quinn in Suicide Squad, which is like very male gazy, very like, you know, like she's great in that role, but like it's very clearly she's framed for the male gaze in that movie. And then when we see her in Birds of Prey, which she produced, how that character is framed so differently. And then part of that is also because of Kathy Yan, the director of Birds of Prey.
Yeah.
You know, frames that differently. But then to see, like, the other work that her production company has done, like Promising Young Woman.
Yeah.
And Barbie, of course. Yeah. And, like, some other things that are, like, yeah, I'm more interested in, I mean, I think she's a great actor, but I'm more interested to see what she does as a producer in the future. So,
I didn't realize she produced Promising Young Woman. Wow.
Yeah. And Saltburn.
Oh, cool. She's so cool.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you see Saltburn?
I haven't yet.
It's kind of eh. Mm-hmm. Like,
okay.
I feel like it's saying things that have already been said a lot in better ways.
Sure.
Yeah.
One of
but
those.
I mean, like, it's a good time if you know that that's what to expect.
What's it about? What is it?
It's basically The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Oh, like, okay.
It's all... So Emerald Fennell, who played Midge in Barbie, by the way, she has cited Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh as, like, the inspiration for Saltburn, but it's The Talented Mr. Ripley.
okay.
It's fine. It's also kind of like, so you know how Parasite was amazing. Have you seen Parasite yet?
I haven't.
Aaron, it's been 5 years. Okay. So Parasite was incredible. And then it, like, kind of set off, like, kind of a wave of, like, Eat the Rich movies, right?
Okay.
So it's an Eat the Rich movie, but it's, yeah, like I said, like, it's not, it's saying things that have already been said and in a less interesting way than they've already been said. But yeah, like, it's a good time if you know what to expect going into it.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, what were we talking about?
We were wrapping up.
We were talking about Margot Robbie.
We're talking about how cool Margot Robbie is.
How cool Margot Robbie is.
So
that's what we'll leave you with.
That's the gift that we'll leave you with. How cool is Margot Robbie?
She's really cool.
The answer is that she's really cool. There
Hi,
we
Margot.
There.
If
we
you're listening, you're welcome anytime on the podcast.
Do you want to come over? You could hang out.
You want to come over? We'll have a dance party.
Yeah. Oh, I want her outfit. Do you have a favorite outfit from the Barbie?
Ooh, my favorite Barbie outfit. None of it is really like my vibe. Like,
yeah, sure.
It's not my style. I wouldn't wear it. Uh-huh. I do like her yellow dress when she.
Aww.
When she, you know, talks to Rhea Perlman in the, like, white void. I like that dress. Yeah, I think that's probably my favorite. What about yours?
The dance party outfit.
The disco.
The disco one.
I'm disco Barbie. Remember in Never Been Kissed when at the prom, like, all three of the popular girls are different Barbies. They're like, I'm disco Barbie. I'm evening gown Barbie. And then Drew Barrymore is like, we're Rosalind in Orlando from As You Like It. And they're like, what? And she's like, medieval Barbie. I've seen that movie a lot. That's so medieval Barbie. You're medieval Barbie. And then the guy that she's like, that is like her date, is like, look, I have a sword. And they're like, ooh. Okay. I might need to rewatch Never Been Kissed. So
yeah,
we should probably wrap this up. We've got more Barbie to come.
We do.
We're gonna finish this series. We promise.
We are.
And then, you know, we might do something totally different. We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for that. Yeah.
Stay tuned.
We haven't posted on Instagram in a really long time. We'll try. We'll try.
We're gonna try.
Yeah. But yeah. Have a lovely day, my friends.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And
go to therapy.
Go to therapy. It's good.
Yeah. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
It's basically the talented Mr. Ripley. Like, it's, but it's all, so Emerald Fennell, who played Midge in Barbie, by the way, she has cited Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh as, like, the inspiration for Saltburn. But it's the talented Mr. Ripley. It's fine. It's fine. It's also kind of like, so you know how Parasite was amazing. Have you seen Parasite yet? Aaron, it's been 5 years. Okay, so Parasite was incredible. And then it like kind of set off like kind of a wave of like Eat the Rich movies, right? So it's an Eat the Rich movie, but it's, yeah, like I said, like it's not, it's saying things that have already been said and in a less interesting way than they've already been said. But yeah, like it's a good time if you know what to expect going into it. Yeah. Anyway, what were we talking about? We were talking about Margot Robbie. how cool Margot Robbie is. Yeah. So that's what we'll leave you with. Yes. Love it. She's really cool. Hi, Margot. If you're listening, you're welcome anytime on the podcast. You want to come over? We'll have a dance party. Anyway. Ooh, my favorite Barbie outfit. None of it is really like my vibe. Like, it's not my style. I wouldn't wear it. I do like her yellow dress when she does the, when she, you know, talks to Rhea Perlman in the like white void. I like that dress. Yeah, I think that's probably my favorite. It's a good one. Yeah, what about yours? Sure, the disco. I'm disco Barbie. Remember in Never Been Kissed when at the prom, like all three of the popular girls are different Barbies? They're like, I'm disco Barbie. I'm evening gown Barbie. And then Drew Barrymore is like, we're Rosalind in Orlando from As You Like It. And they're like, what? And she's like, medieval Barbie. I've seen that movie a lot. So you're medieval Barbie? And then the guy that she's like, that is like her date is like, look, I have a sword. And they're like, ooh. Okay, I might need to rewatch Never Been Kissed. So we should probably wrap this up. Yes, we've got more Barbie to come. We're gonna finish this series, we promise. And then, you know, we might do something totally different. We'll see. We'll see. So stay tuned for that. Yeah. Yeah. We haven't posted on Instagram in a really long time. We'll try. We're gonna try. Yeah. We're gonna try. But yeah, have a lovely day, my friends. And yeah. Go to therapy. Yeah. Okay. Okay, bye.